طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. A debate about the power in Washington of the pro-Israel lobby is underway after Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota, responded sharply to reports that Republican leader Kevin McCarthy was targeting both Omar and fellow Muslim Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan. Omar quoted rap lyrics, "It's all about the Benjamins, baby," to suggest McCarthy's move was driven by the lobby's prolific spending. Asked specifically who she was referring to, Omar responded, "AIPAC." The debate over the influence of pro-Israel groups could be informed by an investigation by Al Jazeera, in which an undercover reporter infiltrated the Israel Project and secretly recorded conversations about political strategy and influence over a six-month period in 2016. That investigation, however, was never aired by the network, suppressed by pressure from the pro-Israel lobby. In November, Electronic Intifada obtained and published the four-part series, but it did so during the week of the midterm elections, and the documentary did not get a lot of attention then. That Al Jazeera report documents Representative Omar's point about the influence of AIPAC over congressional elections, including the flow of money. Amy Goodman, on her news program Democracy Now!, further exposes AIPAC and the greater Jewish lobby in this interview with investigative reporter Glenn Greenwald.
I want to first go to one of your recent tweets that's making news today. On Sunday, you tweeted, quote, "GOP leader Kevin McCarthy threatens punishment for Ilhan MN, Ilhan Minnesota, and Rashida Tlaib over their criticisms of Israel. It's stunning how much time U.S. political leaders spend defending a foreign nation, even if it means attacking free speech rights of Americans," you wrote. Well, Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota retweeted your post and added the line, "It's all about the Benjamins, baby." Then an opinion editor from the Forward newspaper tweeted, "We'd love to know who Ilhan thinks is paying American politicians to be pro-Israel, though I think I can guess. Bad form, Congresswoman. That's the second anti-Semitic trope you've tweeted." Ilhan Omar then responded to that tweet by writing, "AIPAC." Democratic Congressman Max Rose responded to Omar by saying, "Congresswoman Omar's statements are deeply hurtful to Jews, including myself." So, Glenn, can you respond to all of this?
This is all so ridiculous. It's all based upon this demand that we indulge what everybody knows is an utter and complete fiction, which is that we're allowed to talk about the power of the NRA in Washington. We're allowed to talk about the power of the Saudis in Washington. We're allowed to talk about the power of big pharmaceutical companies and Wall Street and Silicon Valley and the fossil fuel industry in Washington. But we're not allowed to talk about an equally potent, well-organized, and well-financed lobby that ensures a bipartisan consensus in support of U.S. Defense of Israel. That the minute that you mention that lobby, you get attacked as being anti-Semitic, which is what happened to Congresswoman Omar. And I think the context here is really important. for a long time, the bipartisan piety was not just that the U.S. has to support Israel, but that in particular the effort to boycott Israel in protest of its occupation of Palestine is not just misguided, but anti-Semitic. That's the official position of the Democratic Party, of Hillary Clinton, of Chuck Schumer, of every leading Democrat. And now suddenly you have these two really exciting, dynamic, charismatic women of color newly elected to Congress, the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, who both are supporters of the boycott of Israel, which the Democratic Party says is bigotry and anti-Semitism, and it's created this very awkward moment. So, of course, the minute two Muslim women arrive in Congress, they're going to get attacked as anti-Semitic if they're critical of Israel, which they are. Just like Keith Ellison, the first Muslim ever elected to Congress, got vilified as being an anti-Semite by Chaim Sabin, the billionaire funder of the Democratic Party, when he tried to be the chairman of the DNC. What the congresswoman said is very uncontroversial. Everyone knows AIPAC is an extremely intimidating lobby, just like the NRA is. There's nothing wrong with pointing that out. There's certainly nothing anti-Semitic about saying that, about criticizing the Israeli government for its aggression and militarism. And anybody who cares about Palestinians and about the ability of Muslims in the United States to be able to speak freely ought to be defending her. And the last one I would add is my point was in saying what a how weird it is, what a priority it is for U.S. politicians to defend Israel, was based on the fact that the very first bill passed by the U.S. Senate was not about helping Americans. It was about empowering states to punish people who support a boycott of Israel, a bill sponsored by Marco Rubio, who got more money from Sheldon Adelson than any other politician in 2016, and then was supported by half of the Democratic Senate caucus. That's what I was referring to. And the congresswoman was saying a big reason for that is the moneyed interest in Washington that demand that. And of course, everyone knows that's true. And to call that anti-Semitic is just obscene.
I'll add, Chelsea Clinton also tweeted, "I will reach out to her tomorrow." She wrote this last night, Ilhan Omar. "I also think we have to call out anti-Semitic language and tropes on all sides, particularly in our elected officials, and particularly now," Chelsea Clinton tweeted.
Yeah, who is Chelsea Clinton to become the spokeswoman about what is and isn't permissible debate when it comes to Israel? Her parents are probably the two individuals most responsible for turning the United States into a steadfast defender of an apartheid, murderous, and oppressive regime in that region. Her two parents are probably the leading politicians most responsible for ensuring the ongoing repression of the Palestinian people. So Chelsea Clinton, who I don't think has any public status other than being the daughter of two famous politicians, really has no place in trying to set the boundaries of what is and isn't permissible debate, given what her family has done, so much harm to ensuring that Palestinians don't live with the basic minimum dignity and sovereignty to which every human being is entitled.
That was investigative reporter Glenn Greenwald, as interviewed by Amy Goodman on her program, Democracy Now! And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a lecture given by local Palestinian scholar and professor of political science at UMass Boston, Leila Farsakh, who speaks to the current political situation in Palestine. Here is Professor Leila Farsakh speaking at Tufts University.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and I have to say the title is a little bit different, but we thought of this title as more catchy. So I am indeed going to talk about partition, and I'm going to talk about the two-state solution, but really the perspective I want to talk about is how far the Palestinian decision to opt for a two-state solution and call for a Palestinian state was a good decision or a bad decision. Because nowadays there's a very big debate on how far the Palestinians, given the failure of the two-state solution, many argue it was stupid of the Palestinians to argue and defend for a Palestinian state. The Palestinian struggle was about liberation, was about return, was about independence, was not about a state. And having fought for a Palestinian state has actually led the Palestinian to lose more than to gain, and we see that with the reality on the ground today. So, and there is a very big concern about how far the two-state solution has been killed, is dying, but also at the same time how much the international system is very much still invested in the two-state solution. And we've seen it lately, I mean, it's not so lately, but, you know, with the Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, that is considered for many as a clear indication that this is killing the two-state solution. Kerry, the Obama's last Secretary of State, warned about the danger of having the two-state solution being killed, because it's going to be dangerous for the Israelis and Palestinians. So what I want to do is to see how much really is partition has always been the default solution to the conflict, and how far partitions and the two-state solution were really optimal. And optimal in the sense of how far the key documents, the key international documents, which are central to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, basically the Balfour Declaration, the UN Resolution 181, which affirms partition, as well as UN Resolution 242, which becomes the basis of all peace negotiation and the basis for peace between Israel and its neighbors, including the Palestinians, have really enshrined or not the two-state solution. And what I would like to do is, in order to understand how far the struggle for statehood was a good or a bad strategy, is I would like to examine how these three documents, which are key to the conflict, really deal with the concept of self-determination. This is a key concept that in international relations, a key concept of the 20th century, to affirming the right of states to have a state. Okay? And basically what I'll try to examine is how far this concept of self-determination, which is being revived again today, how it has been dealt with. In other words, who has the right to have self-determination? And what is the relationship between the nation and the state? Because whenever we talk about self-determination, we talk about the right of a group of people to define themselves as a nation and to create a state. But this relationship between the nation and the state, does every nation need a state? Or can you protect national rights without having your own state? This relationship between nation and state was actually much more complicated than when we think of it. And I will explore how far partition and the claim to state are the only vehicle for any national group, be it Israelis and Palestinians, to have the right to have rights, which is an expression first put by Hannah Arendt, or whether the quest for self-determination can be achieved otherwise. This question seems to me all the more important today, as the pursuit of partitions has seemed to be very futile, and many are arguing that all energy should be put in thinking of a one-state alternative for Israelis and Palestinians. I will not go into the debate of the one-state, two-state, though, in this lecture. What I will focus on is what has been lost and gained in the Palestinian accepting partition or the two-state solution. And I'll argue that actually the Palestinian state project was a necessary and not futile endeavor, but that its role has also come to an end. So how will I do that? First of all, I will start to describe with you how the concept of self-determination was discussed in the Balfour Declaration. As I say, the concept of self-determination has been at the heart of the international system since the Bolshevik Revolution, or since the Wilson 14 points of 1918. It is a political notion that acknowledges the right of people to define themselves as citizens and a part of a nation, however this nation is imagined, and to tie individual political rights or citizenship to being part of a national collectivity. Although the status of self-determination as a norm of international law is no longer challenged, the content and application of self-determination remains contested. In particular, the link between self-determination, territoriality, and sovereignty has often been called into question, as many legal scholars argue that sovereignty is tied to the people, not to the land, and does not need to be expressed in territorial terms. Moreover, many people have argued that the concept of self-determination is as much a term used by the colonized people to evoke their right for independence, as well as a term used by colonial power to assert imperial dominations. And I think the British mandate system imposed on Palestine provides a classical example of how the concept of self-determination was both a tool of colonial control and a means to claim the right to national independence. The British mandate acknowledges Palestine as a Class A mandate and that's entitled to be independent, but at the same time acknowledges the Balfour Declaration that denies the Palestinians political rights. It gives political rights to the Jewish population, but denies Palestinian Jewish rights, Palestinian political rights. This being said, it's important to remember that the British mandate dealt with Palestine as a single entity. It dealt with it as a single entity, at least up until 1929, and it did not prioritize the nation over the state. Rather, the British mandate made the state above the nation by drafting a single constitution for Palestine, and it defined Palestinian citizenship as one that included all those residing in Palestine at least 2 years of the year of applying for citizenship. This means it included Jews, Muslims, and Christians, immigrants, and non-immigrants. Although Britain privileged the Jewish immigrant over the native Palestinians, its conception of Palestinian citizenship was one that protected individual political rights of Jews, Muslims, and Christians, while acknowledging the collective rights of Jews and Arabs to self-determination. The big problem, though, was defining this relationship between the nation and the state. In other words, how to express the right to self-determination by insisting on a nation state is something that vexed both Zionists and Palestinians during the mandate period. Yehuda Magnus and Martin Buber, for example, who were members of what was defined then humanist Zionism, the Brit Shalom and Ehud group, argued that the Jewish people did not need a Jewish state to be a Jewish nation. This view was not shared by mainstream Zionist movement, who insisted that only a Jewish nation state would protect Jewish rights. Palestinian leaders, meanwhile, did not seem to have been much engaged with the notion of Jewish rights or minority rights for Palestine. While some accepted the concept that Jews have a right to self-government, the majority conceptualized Palestine as an Arab state in which the Jews have a place as equal Palestinian citizens, not as Zionist colonizers. So Palestinians, of course, were not the first one to think of Zionism as a form of colonialism. Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky, two key leaders of the Zionist movement, never denied that Zionism is a colonial project. But they justified the colonial project in terms of protecting Jewish national rights. Hannah Arendt, who was supportive of the idea of a Jewish national home in Palestine, but opposed the notion of Jewish statehood, was perhaps one of the most astute political Jewish critics of Zionism as a colonial project. Already in 1945, just as the Holocaust seemed to have provided the strongest argument for the creation of a Jewish state, Hannah Arendt argued that Zionism was led by European Jewry engaged in an imperial project rather than in a decolonizing revolution, as Ben-Gurion argued. She also argued that this imperial project of Zionism is done at the expense and not at the service of the Jewish people. In her view, and here I quote, "The nation state is neither capable of protecting the existence of the nation nor able to guarantee the sovereignty of the people, for the nation state is based on exclusion." In her view, the nation state was bound to disenfranchise those who don't belong in the nation and thereby produce refugees, people, in her view, which have no right to have rights. The right to have rights, as argued Arendt, came from being part of a political community in which one is recognized by others as a moral equal. She considered the state, not the nation, as the highest form of political community, by virtue of the state being a legal institution with monopoly over the use of force. And the only one, in her view, only the rights of men and citizens, she was a little bit not very gender correct, but anyway, here I'm quoting, only the right of men and citizens are primary rights, whereas the rights of nationals are derived and implied in them. So in other words, you need to separate the state from the nation. The state is what protects the rights of everybody. If you're going to make it a nation state, the nation state is going to eliminate those who don't belong to the nation, denies them their political rights. She argued that the only solution in Palestine is a federal state that would protect Jewish collective and individual rights and responsibilities, as well as ensure their equality with Arab political rights. As she put it, and here I quote, "Equality is not given to us, but it is the result of human organization insofar as it is guided by the principle of justice." She says, "We are not born equal, We become equal as members of a group on the strength of our decision to guarantee ourselves mutual equal rights. So if she was thinking this way, how does this can translate to Palestine? This, I think, is a question that vexed many people at the end of the Second World War, being aware of the Holocaust and trying to find a solution to Palestine. So defining and protecting mutual equal rights of Jews and Palestinians in Palestine was the challenge that the international community was asked to address when Great Britain handed on the file of Palestine to the United Nations. The United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, which was created to recommend a solution, or the kind of political community that you can create to solve the enmity between Zionists and Palestinians, debated for long what would be the best way to meet the rights of those claiming self-determination in Palestine while also addressing the Jewish refugee crisis in Europe after the Second World War. While the UNSCOP, this committee that was created by the UN, was unanimous that Palestine could not be the only solution to Jewish refugees, the UNSCOP member could not agree on whether the two nation states or a single democratic state would best protect the right of Palestinians and Jews in Palestine. You have to bear in mind it was very difficult at the time because in Palestine, in 1948-47, Jews represent one-third of the population, but there was also this crisis of refugees. What do you do with them? Which is a question that in today's world will be as pertinent to what do you do with the Syrian refugees? What do we do with the Mexican immigrants? What are the rights of refugees or migrants escaping war with the rights of the nationals of any state? So the UNSCOP report was particularly... The UNSCOP recommendations are, in my view, particularly interesting today because they provide us a glimpse into how the international community dealt with the concept of self-determination when it pertained to Europeans and non-Europeans, to refugees, as well as to indigenous population. They also provide us into insight into how the international communities viewed solutions based on territorial partition as just or problematic answers to meet the collective and individual rights of people. As it might be known to most of you, the UNSCOP report came with two reports. It came with the majority report, which recommended partition of Palestine. Yeah, that's you see on the map here. One that recommended the partition of Palestine, which is called the majority report. It's called the majority report because it was recommended by seven judges, which formed, the UNSCOP report was formed of 11 judges. Seven of them recommended partition. And three did not recommend partition. Three of them recommended a one single state. And one represented abstain. Okay? The majority report recommended partition was endorsed by seven members. And interestingly enough, all these seven members that recommended partition of Palestine, and it's a plan that proposed to give the Jewish state 56% of historic Palestine when the Jews only represented one-third of the population. Okay? Those who recommended this partition plan, interestingly enough, were all European and Latin American countries. While the minority report, supported by three judges, were representative of India, Iran, and Yugoslavia, very interesting, called instead for a federal state in Palestine, inclusive of Jews and Muslims, and Zionists and Palestinians. It is useful today to review the justification of these two proposals, because they show us how much they tried or not to deal with Arendt's point of how we're going to provide a political solution that provides and protects mutual equal rights of all those living on the land. Now, advocate of partition said that we need to have partition based on three reasons. The first reason they said, the reason why we propose, I mean, it's not ideal partition, but that's the only thing why we're proposing it, is because, here they put between two commas, the irreconcilable claims of Arabs and Jews in Palestine. They said, these two people don't want to live together. There's no point to try to put them together. It's clear the World Zionist Organization has rejected Palestine as a single state, has said it wanted to have its own state, Palestine as a Jewish state, already in 1942. The Palestinian leadership also had rejected the idea of partition. So said that this lack of an ability or willingness to just sit together and find and live in one state makes it that you cannot. There's an irreconcilable request. The best way is to separate. The second rationale for arguing for partition is defined the unwillingness of either group to cooperate with each other. Okay. And the third one and this is very important, it argued that these two people were culturally incompatible. So that's a very important. As it put it, every practical solution today, even the most extreme, is confronted with the actual fact that there is in Palestine today more than 1.2 million Arabs and 600,000 Jews who, by and large, are from different cultural milieus and whose outlook, languages, and religious aspirations are different. And as this quote shows you, they said further that partition would allow each group to unleash its real potential, since the Jews, as you can read here, bring to the land the social dynamism and scientific methods of the West. The Arabs confront them with individualism and intuitive understanding of life. Here then, in this close association, through the mutual emulation of each other, can be evolved a synthesis of the two civilizations, preserving at the same time their fundamental characteristics. In each state, the native genius will have a scope and opportunity to evolve into its highest cultural form and attain its greatest reach of mind and spirit. So, the Oriental, what we call today Orientalism of the West, is clearly manifested here. Jews and Arabs are incompatible because they have two different races, two different cultures, and they're better off being separated because their potential will be unleashed. Now, of course, the Orientalist tone of the majority report was probably not missed on the three members that dismissed it and descended from it. The underlying assumption in the majority report that separate makes equal did not seem to sway the representatives of India, Iran, and Yugoslavia, who instead recommended that a single federal state in Palestine is the best solution. The minority report argued that partition, actually, was unfeasible for three reasons. One, it divided Palestine politically and geographically into territorial non-contiguous states, which you can see here, right? The partition plan cut the area in a non-contiguous way. It said this is not going to work practically. How are you going to separate, you know, and every part of the Jewish states need to connect one with its other part, needs to pass through the Arab state and vice versa. Second, it said that partition was unworkable because it did not enable the Arab state to be economically viable, which was an assessment that already the majority report said it is true. We need to find a way to help the Arab state because in such a split, the best land is given to the Jewish state. The Jewish economy is much more developed. So in this scenario, the Arab state will be less developed. We need to find a way. So the federal state said partition doesn't work because it is not feasible to cut. Secondly, it's not going to make the Palestinian Arab state viable. And thirdly, and most importantly, it said partition plan is unfair for, and here I'm quoting, it outweighed the aspiration of the Jews over the well-being of the country and its people as a whole. So it was trying to think of the justice, like how do you favor the immigrants or a minority over a majority? How do you make a balance? It's unfair if you split in this way, you're gonna favor a minority over a majority. So it said, in other words, the minority report considered partition not based on justice, and it did not guarantee mutual equal rights, as Arendt argued. The minority rather advocated for a binational state, which was already proposed by the Zionist left at the time. Okay, it maintained that the best that a single state would protect self-government and cultural autonomy of both groups, as well as avoid the creation of national minority groups, which most nation-states today deal with. How do you deal with minority rights? Is that if you create a single state, you will not create minority rights, which is what Israel is dealing with the minority right of Palestinian citizens of Israel. It also said that it is the solution which is most in harmony with the basic principle of the Charter of the United Nations. And in terms of feasibility, it also argued that there is enough historical evidence to show that Arabs and Jews can work together and have worked together and can be helped to work together. Although the minority report was aware that the will of Arabs and Jews to cooperate was questionable in 1947, it said there is enough historical evidence and there is a role for the UN to help them create and work together to find a solution. It also proposed that there would be a transitional period in which an authority of the UN would be created to help two groups work together. And it also included that the Arab and Jewish citizens, as well as non-citizens who were resident in Palestine up to 3 months before the independence of Palestine, would be given citizenship. In other words, it tried to accommodate the right of citizens with the right of immigrants. Okay? Now, as you know, Minority Report was very beautiful, did not pass, was not voted on, partition was voted on, passed, with lots of muscling, you know. But what's important is that Israel did not stick to the partition plan, and instead of sticking to 56% of Palestine, Israel took 78% of Palestine. What is important is this, is as Hannah Arendt predicted, the new nation state Israel rid itself of what it defined as not nationals, which are the Palestinians, expelled them from their land, 2/3 of the population. And perhaps the clearest manifestation of the loss of Palestinians of their right is UN Resolution 242 in 1967, after the 1967 war, which became the base of all peace settlements. It's a resolution that reasserts the admissibility of land acquisition by force, okay, but in exchange for recognizing all states. But it's also a resolution that does not admit the existence of a Palestinian problem. It only calls for a just solution to the refugee problem. It does not mention any UN resolution, neither 181, which is the partition plan, neither 194, which is the right of refugee to return. It does not mention the word Palestinian. This UN resolution 242, which is the basis of every peace settlement between Israel and its neighbors. It is the basis of the peace settlement between Israel and Egypt in 1978. It is the basis of the Oslo peace settlement between Palestinians and Israel. The base of the peace agreement between Jordan and Israel. This UN resolution does not mention the word Palestinian. It calls just for it. The only thing it calls for a just solution to the Palestinian. No, just solution to the refugee question. Okay? The Palestinian National Movement, so in other words, what the UN Resolution 242 did, it erased the Palestinians and turned them into a humanitarian problem in need of a humanitarian solution, not a political struggle requiring political recognition and justice. You see this debate between are we going to turn it into a humanitarian crisis or is it a political problem? UN Resolution 242, this resolution we still talk about all the time, to which the Palestinians even signed on with the Oslo Agreement, negates the existence of the Palestinian people and turns the Palestinian into a humanitarian problem. Now, one can argue that the Palestinian National Movement since 1967 has focused precisely on restituting the Palestinian rights to have rights by claiming the right to a state and not just liberation. The focus of on the Palestinian state can be seen in the PLO's Democratic State slogan in 1971. It also one can argue that the PLO trajectory from 1970 or 1967 until also in 1993, as one in which the Palestinian National Movement came to term with partition as the only solution to establish a state, a Palestinian state, albeit on part of Palestine. One that can protect their right to self-determination. In other words, the Palestinians said, okay, the only way how we can have right is to have a state. The only way how we can have a state is to claim the right to self-determination. The only state we can have is on 22% of Palestine, which is the West Bank and Gaza. This is better than nothing, because once we have a state, we can have some rights. That's really the calculation that the Palestinian leadership went for with Oslo. Okay? Although the Oslo Agreement did not specify its end goals, it provided the first official Zionist recognition of the existence, rather than the erasure, of the Palestinian people and their claim to political rights. Israel Prime Minister's willingness to recognize a Palestinian state in 2009, albeit with very specific and unacceptable conditions, still meant that Israel admitted of the notion that Palestinian rights to a state is the only way for them to have some rights. Okay. The question is then, why, despite all this recognition, the fact that the Palestinian state today is recognized by over 80 states, has been admitted to the UN in 2012 as a non-member state, the conflict is not over? And the answer, of course, is to be seen and to be found in the Oslo Agreement, which reformulated rather than ended Israeli or Zionist colonization. The doubling of the settler population in the West Bank and Gaza between 1993 and 2018 to over 600,000 settlers, the construction of over 700 kilometers of separation barrier, the institutionalization of 99's checkpoints, all that meant that the Palestinian state's idea has been trivialized, and what the Palestinians today have is Bantustans. The state that everybody wants has been trivialized, and the Jewish nation state, as Hannah Arendt predicted, could not but become imperial, as Israel today privileges the rights and security of over 6 million Jews over an equal number of Palestinians who remain either under siege, living in Gaza, living without sovereignty in the West Bank, or without full political rights inside 48. So where do we go from here? So was the Palestinian pursuit of a state a waste of time? In my view, it wasn't, for it was the only means for the available for the Palestinians to affirm the right to have rights, which the Balfour Declaration and UN Resolution 242 denied. This is no minor achievement given the regional and international imbalances of power, as well given Israel's strength and priorities. However, the historical role or the political currency of the Palestinian state project, in my view, has come to an end, largely because the international community did not hold Israel accountable to its signed agreement. The limitation of the two-state solution, this end of the historical role of the Palestinian state project is both an impasse and an opportunity. It is an impasse because the two-state solution is the only one we have, for which we have international resolution to support it, and international and institutional mechanism to sustain it, but no international will to impose it. Do you see? So we have an international legal system to support it. We have institutions that build it, but we don't have an international will to implement it. But this failure of the two-state solution also, in my view, offers an opportunity as it forces us to rethink self-determination and statehood in the 21st century. So how do we move forward? That's, I suppose, what everybody is asking. It's that. What shall we do now? Well, what you do now is some very, very, very hard work, which became unavoidable. It's undoubtedly there is a role for the international community to play, whether in holding Israel accountable to international law, be it by stopping the settlements, retreating from the land it occupied in the 67 war, or reaffirming the right of return. This pressure, though, will not be enough without Israelis and Palestinians confronting what I consider the most important and necessary ethical and political limitations of their national struggles. And thereby, they need to undertake two very important tasks. First, Palestinians and Israelis leadership, intellectuals, whatever you want to call them, people, need to redefine the relationship between territory, sovereignty, and boundaries. Palestinian and Israeli nations do exist today and are alive and kicking, but no one can be superior to the other. Nor can they be above a state of rights. Self-determination can be expressed in different territorial configuration or without any, but it needs a state that respects and protects the collective and individual right of all those who live on the land. Secondly, I think Israelis and Palestinians need to address the other as an equal, not separate. The other as equal in right and responsibility, be it in a one state, two state, three state, whatever state you want. But the question of equality is coming to the core again. And this means that they need to face their common history and their destiny and address two other important questions. I think, in my view, the Israelis need to confront what I define as the Arab question. Namely, accepting its responsibility towards the Nakba rather than excuse it because of the Holocaust. It also implies that Israelis need to face the incompatibility of Israel's claim to be a Jewish and democratic state, as well as the injustice done to the Jews of Arab origins. This is a very difficult conversation for Israelis to have, for it requires that Israelis undo the colonial orientalist foundation of Zionism. At a fundamental level, it implies that Israelis need to confront the Arab dimension of their Jewishness. Zionism cannot deal with that, such a dimension, for it defined itself as a civilizing Western enterprise seeking to universalize the Jew, including the Arab Jew, and turn him into an enlightened, i.e. Western Ashkenazi Jew. Recognizing the injustice to the Arab Jews in Israel is as much important as it is for also to happen in many Arab countries. Palestinians, for their part, I think, need to confront what can be defined as a Jewish question, namely Jewish attachment to Palestine, and that Zionism's outcome is not only colonialism. This is the hardest thing for Palestinians or Arabs to deal with. How do we deal with Zionism? And can Zionism be anything else than colonialism? And I think if you accept the existence of something called Jewish nation or something called Israel, or the fact that there are people who are in Israel who speak Jewish, are attached to their Jewishness, Hebrew language, to the West, whatever, the real question is, can Zionism be decolonized? The Palestinians, this does not mean that Palestinians can accept Zionism or give up dismantling Israel's colonial structure. But it does mean that Palestinians need to explain how to decolonize Israel without negating the collective rights of Jews and the cultural identity they created over the past 70 years. This implies that the democratic state that they advocated in the 1970s cannot just be Arab in the narrow sense of the world. Palestinians need to embrace a multi-ethnic, multicultural discourse that honors the diversity of Palestine rather than confines it to an essentialist Islamic or Arab identity. Reclaiming a state of rights is precisely what the Arab uprising was about. Although these uprisings failed to bring down authoritarian regimes, be it within Egypt or within the Palestinian territories, or to dismantle ethnocracies in Israel or Syria, they did affirm people's determination to reclaim their rights and remind the state of its responsibility to ensure equality for all. If Israeli colonialism is to end and refugees to return home, be they Syrians or Palestinians, Jews or Yazidis, a state of right that is inclusive of all its citizens in their multiple identities remained the only answer. It is also what international law promised to uphold and protect. I'll stop at here and then take your question. Thank you very much.
That was Leila Farzak, political science professor at UMass Boston, speaking at Tufts University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.